National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History Number 2. My name is Bernice Herzog, and my respondent's name is Dr. Sidney Busis. This is Thursday, January 14th, 1993. Sidney, let's go back as far as you can, either from memory or from anecdotes that you've heard, and tell me a little bit about your grandparents, where they came from, your maternal and paternal, and we'll go along that line.
Well, my grandparents came from a small town in Russia called Shadrin. As a matter of fact, those who came from Shadrin, called Shadriners, still meet to this day. It was written up one time in the New York Times, one of the largest and most active Landsmannschaften in the United States. There's a man named Harry Katz who was in the exterminating business. They called him Killer Katz, and he was the man who kept this together. And to this day, we have, at least we're invited to, I don't always attend, I must admit, but we have Shadriner meetings once a year in Pittsburgh or somewhere around Pittsburgh. And since Katz retired to Florida, he has one in Palm Beach. Well, I just heard that recently that he's not having the one in Palm Beach. At least he hasn't had the last year. But I can remember as a child being taken to the Shadriner picnic. It had no meaning to me at the time, but my mother and her mother would take me to the Shadriner picnic. They used to be held in one particular grove in Schenley Park near the swimming pool. As a matter of fact, when I drive through the park now, I always think of, when I pass that grove, I always think of the Shadriner picnics. Shadrin was a town that apparently had a number of Jews, and there was a family named Goloditz, as I recall, who had some lumber business that hired most of the Jewish population. And Sidney Weiner, of blessed memory, who was a physician in Pittsburgh, either wrote or had written for him a book about Shadrin. In fact, we had that at home someplace, I believe. My son is the genealogist in our family, he may know. And we were a Lubavitcher community, so my roots are Lubavitch, even though I'm not a Reformed Jew. And Rabbi Posner of the yeshiva here studied in Shadrin, so he came from that same community. And there were others that I knew who had come directly from Shadrin. When we were in Israel at the Museum of the Diaspora a few years ago, we looked up Shadrin in the computer, and it was there, and they gave the date that the Nazis came in and killed every person in the town. So as far as I know, it doesn't exist, but I can't be sure about that. And my grandfather, I believe, came from the same place. I'm not as clear on my grandfather's side as my grandmother's side, because my grandfather died on January the 10th, 1932. I remember the date, and I remember him when he was sick in bed. He was a fine man. He dabbled in real estate, and he was a great checker player. I remember as a kid going to their home on Pocusa Street, and they would all gather behind the house and play checkers. And I never knew much about it. All I knew was I wasn't allowed to say a word. There was no kibitzing allowed. My grandmother was a matriarch of the family. She died at around 94, I believe, and she was a wonderful woman.
Do you know when they came to this country? Did they come separately? Were they married?
They came together married, and they came in the, I believe, I don't know the exact year, in the late 1880s, because my mother, who was the oldest of their five children, was born in 1892, and I know they were here for a few years before that. And we have pictures of them as newlyweds. And we have a son, Richard, who's married to Judy Beck. And Richard and Judy were the first of our four children who got married, and they had our first grandchild, Sarah. And Sarah is named for my grandmother, which is her great-great-grandmother. And Judy is very sentimental. And on the changing, right above the changing table when Sarah was a baby, she was born October 1st, 1980. But she had a picture of her great-great-grandmother and great-great-grandfathers. It wasn't a wedding picture necessarily, but when they were very young, just married, above her changing table, with a little explanation of it. I thought that was very touching.
Very. What business were your grandparents in, if you can recall that, or having heard? Or if
well,
not,
he was,
let's go
he
to
was
your...
in. No, he was in the. My grandfather was sort of in the real estate business, I think. He owned some property, but before that, before he did that, he was in the, I guess you call it dry goods business. They had a store where they sold clothing and things of that nature and goods that people used to sew with. And they were down on Fifth Avenue in Pittsburgh near Brady Street, 2022 or 2220 Fifth Avenue. As a matter of fact, my mother was born on Fifth Avenue. She died at age 99. She was born in 1892. And we were sitting now at 3471 Fifth Avenue, just some, what, how many blocks away? Maybe 14 blocks away from where my mother was born, which is, I think, sort of interesting.
Right.
And my grandfather was sort of ahead of his time in a sense as far as plumbing is concerned. They had one of the earliest bathrooms. They used to welcome immigrants who would come in. My mother used to tell me that there were five children. She was the oldest. And she used to say when someone would come and knock at the door, all the kids had to sleep on the floor and let the immigrants have the beds. So they used to house immigrants on Fifth Avenue in those years.
And what did your father do?
My father's a pharmacist. My father came to this country in 1910 from a small town in Russia called Mirapol. He came with his crippled mother and his baby sister, who was 5 years younger than he was. My father's father was a cantor in Russia, and his name was Shimon, for whom I am named. And he died as a young man. And my father wanted to leave Russia. He was 16 years old at the time. And I guess at those days they were a little concerned about the army and so forth. So he went to Hamburg, Germany, with his baby sister, 5 years younger than his mother, who was had some sort of problem with her spine. She was like a cripple. They got to Hamburg, and they wouldn't let him on the boat because whether he'd been to Ellis Island or not, we learned what happened was that the steamship company took him to this country, and they didn't pass on Ellis Island. The steamship company had to pay their passage back. So the steamship company would check them over there to make sure there's a chance that they would be accepted. They didn't take anybody that they thought for sure wouldn't be accepted by the American authorities. So they wouldn't accept them to go. They said, we'll take you and your sister, we won't take your mother. And he said he's not leaving without his mother. So he stayed in Germany for about a year and finally got passage. He landed in this country in 1910 at age 17. And he got a job in Pittsburgh. We had some relatives in Pittsburgh. That's why he came to Pittsburgh. He got a job with a drugstore as a delivery boy. And I guess the owner took a shine to him. And before you know it, he was in pharmacy school. And he got here in 1910. By 1916, he had a degree in pharmacy. So then he opened his own store.
And where was this store located?
Well, I believe the first store was on Soho Street, which I don't remember. But then he had some other stores. He eventually had, maybe the first chain in Pittsburgh. It didn't last very long. He called it Busis Pharmacy. And he had one in Stanton Negley, which is still there. The store is still there. He had one in Homestead. He had one somewhere in the Hill District. There was one in town, I believe, where the Roosevelt Hotel was built. I think around that neighborhood, Penn Avenue someplace. But 1929, they all went. And he salvaged just the one, the Stanton Negley, which he had until he died. Well, no, I'm sorry, he didn't have it until he died. He had a major heart attack, and then he retired.
And where did you grow up? What area of the city?
In the East End. We lived at the corner of Hayes and Chislett Street. I was born in the Hill District. I was born on Francis Street, which is right above the colored Y off Center Avenue. And then when I was very young, we moved to Hayes and Chislett Street, the duplex, which is relatively modern. We lived on the second floor, and my aunt, Molly Cohen, who's a member of Temple and still comes to services all the time, her family lived on the first floor. And Molly was my mother, Esther's sister. And in 1929, when things went bad, they lost the house, and the two families moved into a single six-room, I wouldn't say six-room, a small house, one family house on Negley Avenue next to the drugstore, 806 North Negley Avenue. The drugstore was 804 North Negley. And what they did was they had, on the first floor was a little entrance hall, and they a living room, a dining room, and a kitchen. My mother used that kitchen. The second floor had three rooms in it, and they made the back bedroom into a kitchen because it was above the kitchen on the first floor for my aunt, and that was her kitchen. And then the other two rooms in the second floor, one was for one set of parents and the other for the other set of parents, and all the kids lived on the third floor. My sister and I, and my cousin Norman Cohen, Dr. Norman Cohen, his brother Bernard Cohen, lived up there. And then when Harriet came along, Natalie, that's the youngest of my cousins, they kept her in a crib or something on the first floor someplace, I believe. And it was quite interesting getting up in the morning in those days. We had central heat, sort of. We had a coal furnace that we had to stoke, and kids used to take the ashes out and stuff like that. But in the morning, it was always freezing cold. We used to get dressed in Aunt Molly's kitchen. She would light the oven and open the oven door, and that would heat up the kitchen real fast, and all the kids got dressed in the kitchen. We had one bathroom with no shower, just a tub, and the water pressure was so low that when Aunt Molly, who was very diligent in washing, was in the basement washing, there was no water in the bathroom. So we had a signal tapping the pipes. Hit the pipes two or three times, then turn on one water. I forget now, but we had signals to get to from the bathroom to the basement. They turn off the water downstairs so we could get washed upstairs. So that's where I grew up in the East End. I went to first went to Rogers School. Then when we moved, I went to Fulton School. Then I went to Peabody High School.
And where did you go to do your undergraduate work?
University of Pittsburgh.
Graduate?
Both. I went to Pitt the whole time. Fine. Actually, we didn't have very much money at the time, and we couldn't afford actually to go. At those days, you know, the tuition was, $10 a credit, and there were 15 credits a semester. It cost us a total of $300 a year to go to college. Today, they can't go across town for $300, and I was always on a payment plan. I was always going up to some floor in the cathedral with a book of tickets that I would pay off my tuition that way. And I worked, of course, in the drugstore while I was going to college.
Going back a bit, you said that your grandparents were from the Lubavitchers. When and where did you go to Sunday school, or where did you get your religious education in the beginning?
Well, I can say that my father, I honestly believe, was a scholar. He had a huge library, which we still have a lot of the books. One of my sons went into biblical archaeology and ancient history, and he had taken a lot of the books. My father was very liberal. He used to, I'll tell you another story later about him and about the Nazis, if you're interested. But he was interested in religion. I don't know how to classify my father. I would say that he was probably an agnostic, I would think. I don't think he was an atheist. I think he was an agnostic. But nevertheless, he was a committed Jew. In fact, that's why he never made any money in the drug business, because he worked for the community all the time. After he retired, for example, he had an office at the Federation. He was like the perennial cash collection chairman. He used to go out collecting money. But as we were growing up, he was involved in B'nai Israel Synagogue, and he was on the board. He was very active. I think it's fair to say he was like a pillar of B'nai Israel in those days. He was a very close friend of the Rabbi Lifter, Benjamin Lifter, of blessed memory, and Chazon Bloom, of blessed memory, and he was a thinker, and what they would do frequently on Friday nights after service, they would collect in our house and drink tea, and my mother made some things, and have these big arguments about things, I remember as a kid. So that's how I started in religion, by B'nai Israel. I went to B'nai Israel Sunday school, I went to Hebrew school, I went to what we used to call 4 to 6 and 6 to 8. 4 to 6 meant you went from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock, 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday. Then when you got a little bit older, you went 6 to 8, which means you went from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, Monday through Thursday. But we only learned Chumash. We only learned the Bible. Unfortunately, all that time was spent on trying to read the Bible. And I can honestly say that today I can read Hebrew fairly well, almost fluently, I guess, with the marks in. I can't read without that. Some words I can. But I don't have any vocabulary at all. And, you know, today they teach more conversational Hebrew. And, of course, we learned the Ashkenazic pronunciation. Now, of course, we use Sephardic. So I went to Hebrew school there, and it was Bar Mitzvah at B'nai Israel. And I continued my Hebrew education for a short time after Bar Mitzvah, but I didn't keep it up. In those days, I went to Hebrew Institute afterwards. My cousin Norman Cohen went on to Hebrew Institute. That's where he met his wife, Hilda, who was the rabbi's daughter. But I didn't do that.
about your early school days, secular school. Can you recall some interesting anecdotes or stories or some of your classmates who have made it one way or the other? Do you recall any of that?
Well, it's interesting that what I remember is not very profound. I remember kindergarten, for example, and we sat around tables picking bees
colors.
And putting bees in different colors, and that's what I remember. Being embarrassed in grade school by Miss Atkinson, who's probably no longer with us, who was a gym teacher and very strict, and we had a march in line, and if you were out of step, she'd crack you across the shins with a yardstick, which they wouldn't dare do today. And one time she cracked me, she sent me in to take gym with the girls who wore bloomers in those days, and I'll never forget how embarrassed I was. My best friend was Philip Weiss, of blessed memory, whose brother still is in business here, Weiss Provision Company, but Philip and I were very close friends. And he died at a very young age. I don't remember now why he died. I'm not sure I knew at the time. And I remember another impact, a good friend of mine named Howard Johnson, when we lived on Chisholm Street, ran out of his house one day, was killed, and that was one of the shocks that I had growing up. But as far as making it big, my classmates.
Some of your college friends.
I can't think of anybody who, you know, became really famous. Offhand, I'll have to come back to that question later.
That's all right.
I know one thing I learned. People peak early in life. I'm not going to mention any names because it's not complimentary, but when I was in high school, there was a young Jewish man who was handsome, bright, like first in the class, and the star quarterback in the team that won the city championship, and he won a full tuition scholarship to a very prestigious prep school and to a very prestigious Ivy League college, and he ended up doing nothing but working in a post office. So people sometimes peak early, and other people were slow starters and turn out to be terrific.
Right, right. Let's go back again. Tell me about your wife, a little bit about her background.
Well, my wife is Sylvia Amder. Her family's name, I guess, was Amdursky, but most of them are now called Amder. It's a very large, handsome family, I believe. And her father was Sam. He was one of eight or nine siblings, and one of them is still living. That's Aunt Ray, Ray Stewart, who's a member of Temple. She's like 103 or 4 now. Her daughter Phyllis is active at Temple. I met Sylvia in college. In my view, she was the prettiest girl in school and the brightest. She was a straight A student throughout college, and so we got married. As far as her family is concerned, she has a lot of cousins, and I would say that her family is an exceptionally bright family. She has some uncles who were professors at Harvard and so forth, and it's a very bright family. What children do we have, you say?
Yeah.
We have 4 sons.
Tell us a little bit about
their... Neil, Richard, Jimmy, and Billy. And this is one of my favorite subjects.
Okay.
Neil's our oldest son. He was also a very bright student and one of the valedictorians of his class at Alderdice. He went to Yale, graduated Yale summa cum laude with highest honors. And he went to medical school at University of Pennsylvania. And he trained at Johns Hopkins in medicine. And then he did research at the NIH in basic cellular research. Then he went to the Harvard program, Massachusetts General Hospital, where he trained in neurology for 4 years. He stayed on extra year as a fellow in neuromuscular diseases. And I thought he'd be headed for academia, but he and his wife decided that he'd go into private practice. So he's in private practice here in Pittsburgh. He's the only one of our 4 sons still in Pittsburgh. Our second son, Richard, who is 2 years younger, went to University of Pennsylvania because in 1970, we were determined to take our children to Israel. So in 1970, we took all our kids to Israel, our 4 sons. At that time, in 1970, Richie was 17 years old and looking at colleges. And we had a UJA guide in our own car, and he took us all over Israel and went through every dig, every tell in Israel. And Richie got captured by archaeology. So he applied early decision to the University of Pennsylvania because they're very strong in archaeology. And so he went there. He graduated there summa cum laude, too. and was getting his PhD in archaeology and ancient history. He spent several summers digging in Israel. He and his wife, just married then, spent a year in Israel, in Jerusalem, at Hebrew University, studying with a very renowned scholar, and came back to Penn as a graduate student, getting his PhD, and they gave him a class to teach, and he went out and bought a new suit, and it turns out nobody signed up for the class, and he started looking into ancient history and archaeology, and discovered he can never make a living, the kids and, you know, his contemporaries were going out to Podunk teaching history in some small school or college or something, and he just thought he wanted something different. So he applied to Harvard Law School and got into Harvard. And he graduated Harvard Law School, made law review. He was one of the top students in the class. He's now with a Jewish firm called Wolf Block in Philadelphia. Judy's from a Philadelphia family. And she told us that Pittsburgh's her second most favorite city. So they live in Philadelphia. And Richie has maintained his Hebrew. He's fluent in Hebrew. Or fairly fluent, I should say. At this point, he's probably forgotten a lot. But he was. When he lived in Israel for a year, both he and Judy spoke fluent Hebrew. As a matter of fact, today, when they want to communicate in front of the kids, they'll sometimes speak Hebrew. But Richie was pleased. He wasn't there very long. This Jewish firm did some work with Israel, and they sent him there to deal with the Israelis, you know, so this has been helpful to him, his knowledge of Hebrew. Our third son, Jimmy, is 3 years younger than Richie, and he also went to Yale. He graduated magna cum laude. He should have graduated summa cum laude. He missed it by 1 point because he fooled around taking architecture and things he didn't know anything about, but he's a very bright kid, too. He graduated and didn't know what he wanted to do exactly. He had a major in molecular biochemistry and biophysics, and he thought he might like to go to medical school, so he took the MCAS and scored high. He would have gotten into medical school, I'm sure, but he decided he didn't want to go to medical school. He wanted to stay out of school for a while, so he went to work for a company in New York called Plenum Press, Plenum Publishing Company. They have offices in New York and London. And he started out as a manuscript reader, then he became an editor, then he became your advertising manager, and he decided he'd like to move on. But while he was in New York, interestingly enough, he was captivated by Japanese and Japan and so forth. So he went to NYU at night to study Japanese. He became fairly fluent in Japanese, which he is today, not as good as he was because he hasn't spoken it too much recently. So he went to graduate school. He's offered I forget what they call it, some sort of bonus for enrolling. There's a name for that. Anyhow, he got this big bonus at the University of Chicago Business School. And they told him, you know, that you can take some time off, so he went around the world. No, that was later he did that, I'm sorry. He went to the University of Chicago Business School, got an MBA. Then he worked for Booz Allen and Hamilton, and they gave him some sort of a hiring bonus or something like that. He did get a scholarship at Chicago, too, but Booz Allen and Hamilton, management consulting firm that he worked for and still works for, as a matter of fact, gave him this bonus, and he went around the world. He's our world traveler. And so he was in Chicago for a few years, and then he went, he wanted to go overseas. They offered him, the possibility was to go to Tokyo or to Paris. He has a penchant for language. He speaks French fairly fluently, too, and now he's very fluent in French. So they sent him to Paris instead of to Tokyo. So he went to Paris. But while he was in school, as a matter of fact, he won a Japan Society Fellowship and spent a summer in Japan working with IBM. But when he graduated and got his MBA, he went to Booz Allen and Hamilton, and a few years later they sent him to Paris, and he lived in Paris. He got married before he went to Paris. He lived in Paris for 2 years doing business in French, and then something came up in Surabaya, Indonesia, and they asked him if he wanted to go, and he and his wife decided they would go. They're young, so they went to Surabaya. They didn't invite us to join them in Surabaya, although we visited them in France and had a wonderful time. And after about 8 months in Surabaya, he was working a lot out of Singapore office, so that he and the company decided it would be better for him to be stationed in Singapore rather than Paris. So now he's in Singapore, living in Singapore, and working out of the Singapore office. They moved all his furnishings through the Suez Canal, so I presume they plan to keep him in Singapore for a while. But actually, his work is such he travels all the time. I mean, he's in Singapore, headquartered there, but he's right now doing a job in Thailand. So he's in Bangkok 5 days a week, and he flies back the weekends. And sometimes his wife will fly up for a weekend. She's pregnant now. She's expecting a baby in February, so she's staying close to home. But him, and he goes to London, to Australia, to Jakarta, Indonesia, sometimes to, he's been to Seoul. I mean, he just travels around Southeast Asia. And he picks up languages. We went to visit them and went to Bali, which is one of the Indonesian islands. And Bali was wonderful. And while we were there, we had a little driver in a small car. And his wife, Maureen, and Sylvia and I sat in the back. And he sat up front, chattering away and telling jokes in Indonesian with the driver. I said, Jimmy, where'd you learn Indonesian? He said, well, I just picked it up, Dad, you know. So that's Jimmy, our world traveler. An outgoing, very outgoing kid. There's a lot of stories I could tell you about that, but I guess you want me to move on.
Well, just let's go back and give me the present ages.
We have one more child I didn't get to.
Oh, okay.
Want to get the last kid?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Last one's Billy. And Billy's 3 years younger than Jimmy. And Billy also went to Yale. Billy was very confident. He applied to one school, Yale. And I said, don't you want a safe school? He said, don't worry, Dad. Our kids were very lucky. Our kids academically did very well. Jimmy got admitted to Harvard, Yale, and the whole business, but he went to Yale, and Neil did the same thing. But Billy went to Yale and graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa like his brothers did. And he was in physics, Billy. He started to work in laser research for Bell Laboratories in New Jersey. He worked there for about 2 years, decided that he didn't want to spend his life in the laboratory, and he discovered, much to his surprise, that it's a cutthroat business. It seems like it's all rosy, but it isn't. They're very, very competitive. And he found that his boss was not a very nice person, and they're just not nice people. They're very, very competitive. So he decided to go to law school. Either he said, I'll go if I get into Stanford or Harvard. So he got into both, and he went to Harvard. And he also graduated Harvard with Law Review, so he did very well there. He's now working for a firm called Arnold & Porter, which is a large firm. He worked in Washington for a while doing international trade law, which concerned his mother because he was flying to Korea and Colombia and doing this international trade business. And now he's in New York doing litigation, but he hopes to move back to the Washington office. So that basically is Billy.
Okay, go back and give me the ages.
Let me interrupt you here. You're at the end of the tape. 30-minute.
Okay. All right, just shut it up.